Today's episode of The Watch is brought to you by USA's Colony, Season 2 from the executive producer of Lost, Carlton Cuse. Comes another season of the USA original drama, Colony. In the near future, Los Angeles has been invaded by outside forces, and life under the occupation is brutal. Thus, Will and Katie Bowman, played by Lost's Josh Holloway and The Walking Dead's Sarah Wayne Callies, must fight to keep their family safe, but nothing can prepare them for what is to come. Don't miss the new season of Colony, premiering Thursday, January 12th at 10, 9 central, only on USA.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk, now.
Hello, and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRigger.com, and joining me in the studio, it's the New Year's baby! It's Andy Greenwald!
Happy New Year!
Is the New Year's baby's a thing, right?
I just assumed it was a thing that happened on Twitter.
Well, I know they're like New Year's babies. That's like, oh, like, you know, action.
Wait, who is that? The old man?
Like Jim Gardner's like, now we have like a New Year's baby arrived.
Oh, like I was the one born on New Year's
Eve. Yeah, but then isn't the baby also the icon?
Yeah. Yeah, the old year shuffles off.
I just want to get my facts straight, man.
I saw you on New Year's. You knew I was being reborn that night. You saw me go into my chrysalis. It's a new year, Chris. I'm so excited for 2017.
Can I say something? I actually do feel like I have emerged from a chrysalis of some sort.
You did come in with a lot of energy today.
Because I feel like, you know, the cool thing about, even if it's just an arbitrary, you know, flip the calendar kind of thing, I just really like when it's just like all new stuff in front of us.
Yes.
You know? I mean, some stuff in front of us that I'd rather hurdle.
Let's get rid of healthcare for everybody! Woo! 2017! Get sick, baby! Let's do it!
But there's a lot of television coming.
Oh, TV, yeah.
Yeah, and there's, you know...
This feels more essential than ever when you put it like that.
Jamie Foxx has got a movie coming out in January 27th called Sleepless.
When Jamie Foxx has a movie coming out in January... You know it's time to pay attention.
But we're going to start out by reviewing what we've missed, because it's been a couple weeks. We had a couple of those pods that we had pre-taped, like The Wall. People can go check those out. We had the Sam Esmail Best of TV
that
2016.
Was
that was a great one.
A couple things. One thing that we missed, and I just want to go out here and just say you're welcome to Southern California for personally ending the drought.
You're really taking this personally.
Because okay, 2012.
Uh-huh.
Bill Simmons, a guy you know and I've met, has said to me, he's like, you should move out to L.A. because everyone else is moving to L.A. Granlin's out in L.A.
Uh-huh.
And it was the first time that came into my head.
You'd never thought about it before?
Never. Ever.
Okay.
It had never even occurred to me.
Yeah.
I was like Daniel LaRusso in The Karate Kid. Like a jersey all the time. I don't know what I'm talking about. But I was like, I bet if I go.
Do you think Daniel LaRusso walks through Karate Kid and be like, jersey for life, son?
Yeah, inside the shower costume.
Yeah.
I was like, I'll probably end the drought. I personally will do it. Like, if I move there thinking, like, it's going to be warm and sunny,
yeah,
I'll
you seem to have this fixation about it. I said to you, I was like, well, now you get to install your fountain.
Chris, I just feel like my neighborhood in the east side of L.A. needs its own Bellagio.
It's rained like 9 times in the last 15 months.
It's rained so much in the last 2 weeks, and I feel like you're welcome. I think that's a good thing. I don't want people to misunderstand
me. So we
miss
your meteorological takes. What else do we miss?
Just call me Doppler.
Miss some sad news. Yeah. A couple of people passed away from the sort of pop culture world. Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds, obviously.
Yeah, quick thing on that. That was incredibly... I'm not the only person to say this, but the mother passing the day after the daughter was really heartbreaking. We should say a few things about Carrie Fisher. I just want to say about Debbie Reynolds. First of all, one of the best things in the Behind the Candelabra movie. I don't know if people remember that she was in that as Liberace's mother. She was still killing it. She was great. Also, Singing in the Rain, one of my favorite films of all time.
Is it really?
Yes. My daughter's favorite film.
Okay.
Watch it constantly. Kathy Seldon, all-time character. Debbie Reynolds is so good in that. It's just kind of amazing. It's kind of an amazing career and performance. But the Carrie Fisher thing, that just sucks.
Yeah, I was watching some clips from Postcards from the Edge. And that's like a movie they really don't... like. They don't, when they say don't make them like they used to, they really don't make movies like that. I don't think in terms of... just how acerbic and acidic it is. Like, I think that's more of the realm of television now.
I was about to say that. Postcards from the Edge would be an Amazon series today.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, not necessarily. But I don't know necessarily that you would get... Meryl Streep doing Postcards at that time was like about as famous as you could get as an actress, or as big of a name as you could get as an actress. So that would have to be Jennifer Lawrence doing Postcards from the Edge on Amazon for it to sort of mirror up, you know? But that's an incredible movie. If people haven't seen it, that's based off of her memoir. Mike Nichols directed it with Dennis Quaid and Meryl Streep and Shirley MacLaine playing the Debbie Reynolds
it's
role.
It's wonderful that everybody, you know, that people all over the world, our age and a new generation, loves Princess Leia. But the thing about Carrie Fisher is that she was smarter and funnier than anybody else.
Yeah.
And that is a titanic achievement, too.
She's kind of a... There is like a degree to which she was like Hollywood's... She represented like Hollywood's like hidden intellectualism. You know, yeah. I think that in the last... Especially since the late 70s when... The film industry sort of switched over from the new American cinema that people talked about and moved more towards these sort of corporate blockbusters that we're now just kind of take for granted. But Hollywood was this place for where a lot of intellectuals fled the East Coast and fled low-paying writing jobs.
Like, are you describing me right now?
No, I'm just... But that trajectory is not, like... Yeah. It's a pretty well-worn one. And it was... But there was a lot of, like, sort of... Very like bright people who were working in California at the time, and she was among the smartest.
But I also think in terms of presaging a confessional era that hasn't always resulted in the highest of highs.
Yeah,
I don't
right.
mean that as the pun. I don't even mean the pun. She lived this life in the public eye from the minute she was born and struggled mightily in ways that we are fairly comfortable talking about publicly now. But I don't think people were expecting to hear, certainly from their princesses in their sci-fi epics. You know,
no, and owned it in a way that I think is still pretty unique to her, you know?
And the strangest thing about it is, you know, we know from Rob Delaney's piece in The Guardian that she actually filmed all her scenes for Catastrophe Season 3, and that she's very funny on that show. She was funny in everything. And in this piece, Rob Delaney says that Sharon Horgan and he, you know, they write all the scripts. They're the stars of the show. They are maniacal about their dialogue. They let her improvise because no one was going to tell her no, and she was funnier than them.
Huh.
That's why she was coming back from London. She had just finished filming Catastrophe Season 3. We don't know, and these things don't really matter in the face of such a loss, but we don't know what will happen with these Star Wars movies.
She finished
Episode 8, right?
Yeah, she finished her stuff for 8. But they'll have to figure, I mean, yeah.
Dude, she was a queen in 7.
Yeah, she was great.
She was a queen in 7. I feel like people may be dinged on that, but she was a queen.
Oh, in Force Awakens?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was awesome. She was awesome.
You know, another person who... sadly passed away during the Christmas break that we were gone for was George Michael, which, you know, wasn't someone who had been as, you know, obviously hadn't had as much like sort of stage time as Carrie Fisher had had. And these two things have nothing to do with one another. But, you know, one of the things that was neat about all the remembrances of his work was just how much I had forgotten, like, that was a point, especially around the time of Faith and Freedom, where, you know, the biggest pop stars in the world were also often very confrontational. You know, not necessarily punk rock and sound or aesthetic, but between NWA and George Michael and a lot of the stuff that was happening around the late 80s and the early 90s, it was just a really interesting time, especially because you had that the incredible power of MTV and the incredible power of doing a music video and how confrontational you could be visually. And he was someone who would push boundaries even if his sound was relatively traditional.
First of all, Faith was all bangers. That album was so good. And I think that people who are younger who listen to this podcast probably have a hard time understanding how famous he was and how big that album was. Like, that album owned MTV. You could not turn on MTV without a single from that record.
And had like, and those two videos, like the Faith video and then the Freedom video.
Well, that's Listen Without Prejudice.
Right, but I just mean like because
I was building up to that.
But that was back when music videos actually people would do, you know, references within music videos to one another.
Yeah.
So there were the Freedom video burned the leather jacket.
And then 3 years later, he burns it in Freedom.
Right.
I think people should definitely check out our friend Wesley Morris's piece on George Michael that was in the Times over the break. But I just remember the thing about the George Michael Faith era, it's impossible to overstate how big he was, how big those singles were. It was impossible at our age, I think, to appreciate. It wouldn't matter because those were still good songs, but he was the mastermind behind that. He wrote those songs. I mean, he was that talented in front of, you know, behind the microphone and in the studio. One of the biggest memories I have from that era, from 87, 88, and those songs was, I remember reading a story about how all of those songs charted top 10 at what was then called Black Radio, what we now call Urban Radio or whatever. And there was some interesting pieces. Our friend Rembert Brown wrote this too.
Yeah, about Freedom, the MTV classic, the 10th anniversary of MTV performance of Freedom that he did.
And the embrace of George Michael by the African-American community, that those records charted on black radio because of who he was, the way he sang, what he sang about in his message. It's kind of amazing. And then the other thing that he was forward thinking about is he tapped out. He was just like, he wasn't in that Freedom video. He was not comfortable being that guy.
Yeah.
He was 32, I think, when he was just like, nah, I'm good.
Yeah.
And then obviously struggled with a lot of things since. And that's the real tragedy because of his age and because of the relatively reduced output. But that guy was a great pop star.
Yeah, people should check out Wesley and Rebert's pieces on George Michael because those were really good. So let's move on. We'll talk a little bit today about The OA, the new show on Netflix.
Yes, that dropped when we were off and people were chirping about it.
Yeah, and then we'll also be talking a little bit about two Oscar contenders that we both watched at various points over the last couple of weeks, La La Land and 20th Century Women.
Yeah, I think as we build up towards award season, because you know you and I are all about award season.
I love just handing them out.
We you know you've seen all the movies. We should put that out there.
I've missed a couple, but yes, I've seen a lot of them.
In general, you've seen all the movies. I am trying to see more now. Now, guys, I'm sorry, not on airplanes. These are now couch movies.
Yeah,
because I get the screeners. I got the screeners, so I'm watching them slowly, and I watch too. But let's talk TV first.
Yeah.
Oh, and we should also say, a lot of shows coming back Thursday. Right. We're going to get back to some more of them. Taboo is coming.
Homeland back. I know.
And she's home. Not just home. She's in
Brooklyn.
I want
to check out the show The Mick with Caitlin Olson on it.
Are you hype on that?
Well, I just like Caitlin Olson a lot.
Do you think she can she carry this network sitcom?
Sure.
Okay.
Anything's possible.
Wow. Yeah. You are positive this year.
Let's take a quick break and we'll be back to talk about The OA.
Okay.
Hey guys, just want to tell you a little bit about Blue Apron, the food delivery service that I've been using for quite a while now, and it makes a huge difference in my life. Cooking together, you know, cooking with my wife, it builds strong family bonds. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often, and I can tell you that's totally true. The nice thing about Blue Apron is the quality. The beef is raised humanely, the chickens are free range, the pork is raised naturally, the seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. Some of the meals available in January include seared pork chops and farro and cranberry chutney, spaghetti squash and marinara with mushrooms and garlic knots, spicy shrimp and Korean rice cakes with cabbage and furikake. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with shipping by going to blueapron.com/thewatch. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/thewatch. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, man, let's talk a little bit about this show, The OA. It's a new show on Netflix starring and co-created by Britt Marling and Zalbat Manglish, who is, as a lot of people know, the brother of Rostam from X of Vampire Weekend, who just made that Hamilton Lethauser record that I love so much.
These two they're indie film friends. They make movies together.
Yeah, longtime collaborators and a really interesting case where I would say that largely the movies that they make, whether it's The Sound of My Voice or The East or Another Earth, are largely genre fair. I mean, like, it's not out of the ordinary. If they had pitched these movies, or if these movies had come out from major studios with huge $75, $100 million budgets, you wouldn't be surprised. But they go about their business in a different way. They write and produce and direct their own stuff so that one would assume, so that they could have like much more control over it. And it's certainly a really interesting trajectory for Britt Marling, who has largely stayed out of other people's work with the exception of Babylon, the Danny Boyle produced BBC show.
Yeah, which was
quite
good.
BBC or Channel 4?
She was, I don't remember.
The British show.
But it was on here.
Babylon,
on,
yeah.
Sundance, I think.
And she was also in Arbitrage, which was a law crime thriller from a couple years ago with Richard Gere.
And one note, like, I feel like there is a small,
kind of like a Bernie Madoff story.
But there's like a very small tradition of artists coming to Hollywood to make movies and saying, no, I'm just going to make my own stuff for myself.
Yeah.
I guess like sort of Ed Burns kind of thing, although he eventually started acting in other people's
stuff. And even somebody like Danny McBride, who does do that, like still shows up in lots of other people's stuff.
And it's kind of commendable because I don't think there are that many female filmmakers who do that to that degree. And because she is certainly talented and can act in other people's stuff, but they are devoted to their own vision. And this is Netflix doing something that I used to argue for all the time, which is they have so much money. Basically endow filmmakers. You know, Amazon's now doing that too as well. with a bunch of different people, and just basically being like, you know how to do this stuff, and other people weren't giving you money, so okay, try it as a TV show.
Yeah.
Even maybe on some level building off of what we all learned when someone told Sam Esmail that Mr. Robot was too long of a script to be a movie, so it's a TV show, and yeah, that worked. We saw that a bunch in 2016. Joe Swanberg, an indie director we liked, got to make Easy with mm-hmm. mixed results. I think it was okay, but certainly in keeping with this aesthetic. And now we've got The OA, which should not be confused with The OC, but please tell me someone has mashed these
up. I hope so.
I really, really want that.
The OA is...
We're not going to super spoil it, because I'm not finished it.
I'm two episodes away from finishing it. You just watched a couple.
Yeah.
But... so we can talk about it generally.
We'll do a spoiler
one at some point. Hit back a couple weeks from now and do the end of the season. I would say, and this is like kind of going to sound like an underhanded compliment or maybe a backhanded criticism or something, but one thing that runs through Britt Marling's work is that her character, who she plays, often is more or less the savior of humankind, which is an interesting theme to play with. I mean, I think that, like...
This is literally what all actors would do if they could write their own material.
But it's, like, it's an interesting... Like, in The Sound of My Voice, she plays this possible cult leader who could be supernatural. In Another Earth, she is sort of this... The one person who gets to experience the fact that there's, like, a parallel dimension. There are lots of themes that she plays with in... And that she plays with that show up in a lot of different movies and have shown up in The OA. And people will recognize, without giving too much away, like some of the hand gestures that happen in The OA are similar to the ones that happen in The Sound of My Voice. Mm. And just this idea that time and space are malleable and that there are forces greater than we can imagine working around us are things that come up in her work a lot.
Yeah, and I would say building off of that, one thing that we are still not used to, although I think we need to become more accustomed to it in TV, is seeing things that are pretty aesthetically consistent or pure expressions of someone's point of view, of someone's artistic vision.
Yeah.
Generally, the things we see on TV are smoothed, the edges are sanded, and that's not always a bad thing. Often that's a very good thing and a reason why they make, you know, 10 to 20 of them a year and we keep coming back is because they're polished. There are other voices are brought in to make sure that they're a little bit more universal, a little bit more forward facing. We are now in an era where that's not the case. You know, certainly we talked to Sam about that and Mr. Robot is like that. And that's the case here too. And so I found myself watching the beginning of the show almost a little bit at war with my own taste, because there were moments, and there are actually a lot of these moments, I think, as the series goes on, where you're like, okay.
Yeah.
All right. But that's them just chasing this crazy Pegasus muse down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And I do think in broad strokes that's to be celebrated, because it results in moments, moments which certainly exist in the first episode for people who have seen it and people who are thinking about watching it, where you're like, I haven't seen this. I have not seen this in TV.
Yeah. And those moments are structural. They're tonal. We're going to be talking. I mean, I think that it's tough to not give stuff away. So we'll be we're talking very generally about it, but that doesn't mean I think it's just that when you see it, you're just like, it does provide a holy shit moment at the end of the first episode that's pretty unique among shows that I can remember in terms of just inverting some of expectations, but also playing around with like the formal aspects of an episode that you expect.
We'll start at the beginning. I don't think this is a spoiler. The first images of the series are cell phone camera footage mm-hmm. shot in that annoying up and down vertical way that people do when they're not thinking about what they're doing.
Right.
And to see that on Netflix is jarring and kind mm-hmm. of exciting. I didn't expect that. I didn't expect a TV show to start that way. And then what Chris is alluding to is something that happens at the end where it's not a sudden left turn about 60 minutes into like the 77-minute – by the way, episodes are too long – but 77-minute premiere. The bottom drops out.
Yeah.
In a way that feels completely disorienting and thrilling. And it's like, oh, wait, I thought I was watching the show, but I'm watching a video game cutscene. I don't even know what this is.
And it's almost a play on addictive Netflix episodes. Because
yeah.
it's not only does it make you want to start the new episode, it kind of doesn't give you a choice.
That's right. That's right. And it introduces you to what the show is going to be for a while, which is not what you thought.
Yeah. It's basically the basic setup is just, as Andy alluded to, there's this cell phone footage that you see at the beginning of the episode, the first episode, of a woman running across a bridge, and she jumps off a bridge. She lives. That's Britt Marling's character. Her name's Prairie. At least that's what it is in the beginning.
For a minute.
So she's been missing for several years. When she leaves home, she was a blind woman.
Teenager, high schooler.
Blind teenager. And she turns
up. 34-year-old actress.
And now she turns up and she can see. And her parents come and pick her up at the hospital, and it kind of goes from there. And obviously with anybody who recovers from some sort of like a
trauma
like that, there's a lot of attention being paid to her among people in her community, and it kind of just goes from there.
There's a very weird, kind of appealing indie cinema Stranger Things vibe to the first episode. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some suburban malaise, some sort of dark underbelly
stuff.
Yeah,
it's basically
there.
This idea that there's they play up the creepiness and also the drabness of living in a suburban development pretty well.
You know, there are moments, all I can say about this is I'm into it. I mean, I support the show. And what I mean by that is the vision is so specific and so odd and surprising that I am in the show for the long haul. I'm going to finish it. There are moments where I feel like I am completely out. There are moments where I'm like, I don't want to be on this ride anymore. Get mm-hmm. me off. And then there are moments like the one we're talking about at the beginning of the first episode that had me dreaming about the show all night.
Yeah.
They are the sort of people who should be getting these grants, basically, from Netflix.
So I want to ask you a question, because I was kind of surprised when you told me that you liked it.
Yeah. So was I. I was surprised.
This show is pretty stiff.
Totally.
And there are parts of it that almost feel like the dialogue has been run through, like, Google Translate, kind of.
I agree with that, too. People don't talk like this often.
Yeah. And it almost feels like an old book sometimes when you're reading it. Like, the way that people talk to each other just feels like a really anachronistic style of speaking updated to reflect, like, contemporary stuff. But it is ultimately, and it gets more so as you go on, very much a mystery box show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much a show in the tradition of many Netflix binge watches that puts a ton of fireworks in the last 5 to 10 minutes of an episode so that you're like, I have no choice but to continue.
If anything, that's probably the only note they got.
Sure.
Netflix is not very hands-on.
Although they seem like very adept at doing that, so it's not like against their will. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think that at this point you just realize that that's what you can do.
Yeah, I think I'm into it because it's specific and it's unique. There are plenty of moments where you can see the seams. But those are also the moments where I'm like, but this would never have been
like
made.
The bully.
Yeah. But that's sort of an interesting, very surprising character. Or there's a moment in the second episode that's in a flashback where Prairie gets her name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's literally like basal exposition pops up.
Sure.
And it's just like, you know, your eyes are blue like American Prairie. I shall name you Prairie.
Yeah.
And I'm like, come on. Like, but the beauty of that is like, I have an issue with that. Britt and Zal don't, and they're making their thing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of crazy that they're allowed to do it. Now, what I'm curious about is what we will never learn, unless sort of we piece other clues together, like it doesn't get a second season, or maybe it was never meant to. We don't know. But one thing that we have, I do think that we've been able to tell a little bit when Netflix shows are successful. As everyone knows, they do not release any figures. They do not release any ratings.
But you can just sort of sense.
You can sort of sense, and you can also notice things like, on Stranger Things, you know, their star ratings that users give these shows. The OA rocking a lusty 2 stars.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah.
Interesting.
My guess is a lot of people are like, this is the latest mindbender from the studio that brought us Stranger Things. And they're like, I'm sorry, why are we in Russia? What?
Yeah.
And then they're out. You know, I think it'll be an interesting test to see whether Netflix's platform is so big that the point of it is that it's so big is that there's someone for people who like their movies and there's stuff for people who don't and they're not going to cross paths. Or is this delivery system so efficient that more people are going to try this and fall in love with it than otherwise? Although this is not exactly an easy show to love.
Yeah. And I have to admit, I'm trying to interrogate my biases a little bit more right now.
2017,
because, like,
man.
But part of it is like, why do I watch the OA and not Sense8?
You want me to tell you?
Well, do you know? Did you watch Sense8?
I had to back when I used to have to watch
but
TV.
Don't they have fairly, like, they have somewhat similar?
There's a similar messianic nature to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think that Sense8, because it's the Wachowskis, just has the biggest, wildest canvas possible. And some people really respond to that. This, because they come from an indie film background, or maybe they're used to smaller budgets.
It does have a little bit of, like, it's a small story that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And
yeah,
like the Russian nesting dolls, not to put too fine a point on it.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why it's such a surprise when it goes a little bit widescreen, when it does, because I think it's generally what they do is smaller, and I think I respond to that more.
Yeah, and you know what? 9 out of 10 shows would have taken the end of that episode and then spent the next 2 episodes being like, is she telling the truth?
Yeah.
And in this one, it's like, no, like, we're going forward with
this
it.
This is also, and that goes back to, she is the filmmaker. Like, she's
giving
herself the catbird
seat
to do this stuff. It's unique. So let's give ourselves and listeners a couple more weeks to catch up.
Yeah.
This won't be one of those things where we don't come back to it. I promise.
No. I mean, I think we'll be finished. And I know, we're being careful about talking about it just because it does sound like at the end a lot of stuff happens. So I don't want to get too far into speculation about it. We'll just get into it in a week or two.
By the way, like, what a weird world. Just say it again. Like, there is a show called The OA made by these indie filmmakers that just dropped on Netflix over the Christmas break. It's just like, okay, here's this thing.
Yeah.
It's such a weird world we're in. But this, when things like that happen, that's one of the better
things. Yeah, it's like the next couple of months are mostly studio shows, mostly network shows or cable network shows, whether it's Taboo or Legion or Homeland or
Young Pope
or Big Little Lies. So I don't know whether or not there is anything that's just going to be like, yeah, here's 10 episodes of this like mind-bending sci-fi indie film, whatever.
Well,
but
there will be some surprise there. And just as a side note, you know, I participated in Alan Sepinwall's critics poll again this year, and he was very nice to include me since I'm not really a critic anymore, but that was very nice of him. And there was a list of like your 10 shows of the year and the 10 best new shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I filled it out and I was like, okay. Since then, I have been reminded every day of a show that I watched, enjoyed, or considered, we talked about, that I completely forgot.
Yeah.
Like Preacher, I mentioned on the other podcast, I forgot about. Do you remember London Spy?
Yes.
We liked that show.
Sure.
That was really unique
Night
and interesting
Manager
show.
Wasn't even on there, yeah.
I forgot London Spy existed.
Yeah.
I forgot The Detour, the TBS show that I spent an entire podcast just basically in ecstasies over Natalie Z. Forgot about it.
Yeah.
This is a weird, weird time, man. Weird time with TV.
So this actually dovetails nicely into talking a little bit about these Oscar movies, because one of the things that's been weird about this award season is that a lot of these movies have come out in limited release and are now only slowly starting to roll out into wider release. So not to get too into bubbles, but I think it's difficult to really tell. There will be like a critical reaction to La La Land and maybe a backlash to La La Land before people have even seen La La Land.
Is it out?
I believe it is coming. It is out now wide, I believe. Okay. I think it's in Philly. So there's that.
Well, then that's really who
but
we're talking to.
Everything
right now.
From, say, like Patriot's Day is not out yet.
Yeah, which is the thing. So these movies, they get a week release or whatever to qualify for Oscar season, but they don't even exist in the popular imagination yet. Someone was saying that Patriot's Day could be in another American Sniper. Like, this could become actually a huge hit.
Sure.
Even though it feels like it's already come and gone.
Well,
like,
because they were, I think because
Creed.
We were living here, they were marketing it so heavily on local television here, like whether it was during football games or whatever. But I don't know necessarily that they were doing that in Chicago or Austin, Texas.
Let's just say we mean in Philly.
Yeah, or in Philadelphia, the one test market. Anyway, that has kind of made that and the lack of a obvious, clear front runner. There isn't a Gravity or 12 Years a Slave for that matter. There isn't a massive box office hit that wound up being also real awards fodder. And the whole reason
Or the consensus smaller film.
Yeah, and I think that there's been, you know, there's Manchester by the Sea, which a lot of people have adored, but has actually, I think, been because of Casey Affleck's, some of the stuff that's been happening with Casey Affleck or being reported about Casey Affleck has been, like, slowed in its awards potential for something.
Also, as we discussed when we talked about that movie, it's a tough hang.
It is a tough hang, but I actually, now in retrospect, don't think it's that much more of a tough hang than a lot of other stuff that came out this year.
For people with kids, it's a tough hang.
All right. I mean, I still understand human loss.
I know, but I just mean, like, literally, I think I said this on the podcast, like, when I told my wife what the movie was about, she was like, pass.
Yeah.
Just full pass.
So that's made this whole season a little bit jumbled. So unlike television, which has very clear, hey, it's out. Everybody can watch it, whether it's all at once or every episode in a row. The movies are kind of like tripping through the winter here. But that being said, La La Land has started to emerge as a kind of a pretty
Yeah.
Pretty consensus. I think this might win it if it's not Moonlight, if it's not Arrival, if it's not Manchester by the Sea. It's probably going to be La La Land.
Let me say this. It will almost definitely be La La Land. And I don't necessarily say that with praise. I have many opinions that I look forward to sharing with you on a podcast like this one.
Uh-huh.
But if you just look at it, it is movie stars doing beautiful movie star things. It is self-referential. Hollywood loves self-referential films. It is a positive, uplifting experience at the movies. And people like that. And
yeah.
People, I mean, the artist won Best Picture. Nobody remembers that, but like that one.
I see, this, but this I sometimes wonder picture. Whether or not that has more to do with Weinstein than it does with the fact that the artist was about movie making.
I think it's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's all those things. But I think if the, you know, in the say, it's just kind of a safe default thing. Like a war, like historical epics are going to get nominated. They're going to be favorites always. Biopics have a leg up. Movies about movies, generally, especially when they put a happy gloss on it, are going to have a leg up. Chris, I was so ready to love this movie.
Were you?
I was expecting to love this movie. As mentioned on other podcasts like this one, Singing in the Rain, one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
Been watching it constantly.
The music's good in that one, though.
Exactly. Exactly right. You know what else? The people can dance in that one. Also,
I don't mind the
amateur funny and
them,
clever. Look, this is a... Let me start with some positive things.
You're a big fan of The Passenger, The Messengers.
No, I love electronics in jazz.
Yeah.
This movie is beautiful to look at. Mm-hmm. There is no question. Damien Chazelle, this is not the praise I thought I would be giving him. Coming off of Whiplash, and I was like, my God, that movie is a masterpiece of precision and timing. And when I heard he was making a musical, I was so excited because of those attributes. I didn't expect I'd be on this podcast saying what a great photographer he is.
Mm-hmm.
But the composed shots in this movie are beautiful. The way every shot, especially of the city, looks like Los Angeles the way it really is. But particularly a very specific kind of endless purple twilight that is new to me and is quite charming. You know, I was really taken with that.
You think you live in Seattle in 1994? Oh,
yeah, exactly. Because I'm basically starting a band to get on Kill Rock Stars in this weather. The other thing that I need to say, for the record, it's a pretty controversial opinion. Emma Stone is a national treasure. She must be protected at all costs. Her talent is completely off the charts and utterly unique. I have a hard time thinking of other performers who are so completely alive at every second the camera is on them. Effortlessly. It's bizarre. I mean, when in Birdman, I said that her eyes were the best special effect of the year. In this movie, there's such a complete lack of self-consciousness. If you look at Ryan Gosling, who's a tremendous actor, a very mm-hmm. different actor, but a tremendous actor, when he becomes a musical star in this movie, you watch his face and he makes a little smile, like a little aw shucks, here I go with a little soft shoe, and he gives it his all. He's not a good dancer, he's not a good singer, but he gives it his all. But he makes this little like smile that distances him just a tiny bit from what he's doing. It's a performance, he's acting. She doesn't have that. And I think most actors would have that. I'm not, you know, he's one of the best we have. It's really exhilarating to watch her. And though I did not like this movie, Chris, I super hope she wins an Oscar.
So why didn't you like the movie?
There are a bunch of reasons. I found, do you want to say your thoughts too? Do you want to go through beat by beat here?
I liked it. I didn't care for it as a musical, and that sometimes happens with musicals where you're just sort of like, you know, the break away from the narrative is the part where it gets annoying.
But by the way, it's barely a musical. That's the other thing. I feel I was kind of misled.
It's not a musical as much as it's like a song and dance thing. I don't think anybody, I know that some people are fans of the music, but I don't think that it has very memorable music. I think that there's lots of scenes that stop so that there can be a dance sequence, though.
Sure.
And I think it's anachronistic in a sweet way, like, you know, this idea that, you know, the barista at the Warner Brothers lot.
Yeah.
You know, and I enjoyed it while I was watching it. I don't think I'll ever watch it again.
Yeah.
I kind of am fascinated by the version of it that was supposed to be Miles Teller and Emma Watson.
What would that have been?
Well, because I think that Miles Teller would have played that role a little bit more prickish and needy. Whereas Sebastian in the version that Gosling, the Gosling version of Sebastian in La La Land is kind of Prince Charming, even though they have one fight about like whether or not he should go back out on tour.
Yeah.
But that's like the only thing he ever. Oh, he gets mad because he's like, so you're saying you want me to make more money?
Like, it doesn't look like things are hard for him, even though he can't open his silly club.
Like, I just think that if Teller had played that scene, the dinner scene that they have where she's just like, why are you doing this? And he's like, isn't this what you want me to do to put a roof over?
I mean, look, Damien Chazelle is the filmmaker.
I think that Teller would have made that scene a lot more craven.
Yeah, I want to agree with you. The director filmmaker Damien Chazelle is clearly a smart guy. And I'm not just saying that because he went to Harvard. But like, he has to know, unless this really is him, that the character of Sebastian and his point of view is preposterous.
Yeah.
You put Miles Teller in there being like, only pure jazz.
Yeah, right.
You're like, oh, he's kind of a clown.
Yeah.
But something about him is appealing. Gosling is just like an evangelist. And I'm like, oh, I guess.
Also, it's just like you look at Ryan Gosling and you're like, yeah, maybe jazz works out for you. Like, you know what I mean?
Literally,
like,
maybe everything works out for you because you're Ryan fucking
you're just
Gosling.
Like, yeah, like maybe jazz is a good idea.
Like, this is the thing. This is the thing I struggled with the movie more than anything else. Like, anachronism, terrific. Great. Like, an appreciation of the classics. Hey, I like old films. You know, I like the ones that Emma Stone laundry lists at one point. I like pure jazz. I like hard bop. You know me.
Yeah.
But there's there's that, and there's also like a weird, hard-willed, just head in the sand kind of young person's purity that runs through this movie. This movie to me felt like it was made by an extremely young person. Now he's like 7 years younger than us, I think.
Yeah.
This movie, this for me was the movie musical version of a Pitchfork record review, in that it felt like it was written by a hyper, hyper passionate 23 or 24 year old. Someone whose
tastes, actually, he wrote this before Whiplash.
Right. Someone whose tastes are hyper militant. And because they are such, I admire the passion, but a little bit is like, get back to me in a couple years.
Right.
When you've had a little more life. Because so much of it was like his doggedness about this pure jazz. The scene where he mansplains jazz to her is so silly. Her whole thing about wanting to be a star, wanting to be an actor, but we never know why, because we never see her show. We never learn anything. We don't know any points of view. Everything in that character comes from her performance, mm-hmm. nothing that's on the page. There's a lack of self-awareness and a lack of texture. I mean, the dream ending of the movie, you know, is that she gets to marry the dude from That Thing You Do and have a baby. In 5 years?
I think she gets to be famous,
That
too,
shit
right?
doesn't happen in 5 years. That was a quick 5 years. But just in general, like, it's super hashtag basic. And I think there's a difference between romantic and backwards looking in a fun way and simply basic. You know, I just didn't see the texture of life in it that I wished the movie had. Especially a movie that I thought was not throwing us back to a golden age of musicals, but in some ways finding a way to make them relevant and alive for today.
My favorite scene in the movie is when she goes to the pool party and he's playing in the 80s cover band.
That's the best scene in the
movie. And she's making him do like Aha and stuff, like doing requests.
She does Iran, the Flock of Seagulls.
Oh, yeah. And that was, even though it was sort of like an 80s theme, this party you go to, you don't know anybody and you just kind of show up and then you see a person there that you know from kind of before.
He gave you the finger on the highway.
Yeah.
Once.
And that was the point where the movie could have like pivoted towards like, yeah, these wild little dalliant, like these wild musical outbursts happen, like when they're walking through the hills and they start dancing to the like at sunset. And then they're like, should I drive you to your car? And she's like, I'm good. You know, that could have been like a different version of this movie. And then as it goes forward, it just so fully embraces the need to like capture every musical trope it can and pay homage to Hollywood's like, you know, incredible tradition of musicals. It's interesting, though, the way you're talking about it and the way in which it's not. There's a real earnestness to it, which I think you could also call basic. And it actually plays very much into the other film we're talking about, just 20th Century Women, which is also an incredibly earnest look.
I like twee things, man. You know, like I like that. I like the positivity of it in general. There's a review I want to direct people to read, and I can't believe I'm directing people to read this dude's reviews because this dude is notoriously cranky, and I don't always agree with him, but he's certainly passionate about his opinions. That's Richard Brody, who's one of the critics at The New Yorker. He has a review that is
of
La La Land. You can find it online. Just search Richard Brody La La Land. It is super harsh, But I think harsh in a way, it's basically the J.K. Simmons and Whiplash review.
Right.
And I kind of hope Damien Chazelle can stomach it and read this, because it is everything that he points out is good. And he points out specifically the scene with A Flock of Seagulls and what Emma Stone does with her face in that scene and how suddenly the movie comes to life. And everything else feels like Miles Teller's character in Whiplash, in that it is winning by working harder than anyone else. It is a solo when it needs to be an ensemble. And what it lacks, and I do think this more than anything else, it lacked the feeling of wonder that I think can come from musicals.
I think the last 25 minutes have a lot of wonder.
I didn't wonder.
Okay.
I didn't wonder. I don't know whether that means about my calcifying Scrooge-ish heart, but or because I wanted
something. The degree of difficulty with a musical is just really high.
Almost impossible. Yeah. But I wanted it to be good. Maybe this is a case, and I wonder if other people will find this too, where I was spoiled, not by knowing the plot, but spoiled by the rapturous ecstasy with which it had already been received.
Yeah. So with 20th Century Women, speaking of going into it with preconceived notions, I read an interview with Mike Mills, who's the director of the film.
And writer.
And he made Beginners before this.
And he's not the dude from R.E.M.
No. Where he was talking about his distaste for Seinfeld, which is...
Ooh, what?
Yeah. And he was like... Basically, like, he was like, obviously, it's genius, work of genius, but that is just not my kind of thing, where you're basically focusing on the worst parts of people.
Right.
And, like, just sort of, like, the comedy or drama of awkwardness or uncomfortability or whatever it is that kind of captures that Seinfeldian Curb Your Enthusiasm, Louis kind of, like, just really... Oh, God, we're going to have to sit through this whole thing for 6 minutes while we watch this happen. And he was like, that's not why I make movies, or that's not why I make art. Like, if I'm going to get the chance to do this, I want to pursue connection, and I want to pursue this, like, life-affirming moment. And I think that that actually really colored the way I saw 20th Century Women. Because
I would argue Louis does that, too, but go on.
Sure. I mean, you could say Seinfeld does, too. You know, That seems to be the driving force behind 20th Century Women. If you watch it under the idea that no matter how bad things get for these characters throughout the movie, there is something about the voiceover that Annette Bening does, and that a lot of the characters do, but the voiceover that kind of like makes these characters both infinite and small.
Yes.
That is incredibly heartwarming while you're watching it. Like it's just such like a beautiful experience while you're watching it. But then as soon as you get out of it, I think I had a very, very strong reaction to this movie. Like, I loved it quite a bit. But I can see why people are a little bit like, yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah, my feeling is, and so just a little background, Mike Mills is a longtime artist, visual artist. His first film was Beginners a few years ago with amazing performance by Christopher Plummer. And Ewan McGregor is in it. It's also quite good. And that's essentially the movie about his father, who came out as a gay man very late in life. A lot of the things you're describing in 20th Century Women were present in Beginners. You know, I think it's a very affirming, positive film, almost to the point where you keep waiting for the shoe to drop and be a different sort of movie, and it isn't. I like Beginners quite a bit. 20th Century Women is his, this is not me saying it, he said this, this is the movie about his mom.
Yeah.
And with some details changed.
Yeah, it's set in Santa Barbara in 1979, at the end of the Carter administration.
And Annette Bening is raising a teenage son alone. The father in this movie is absent. Mike Mills' father wasn't absent, but that's one of the changes in it. And living in the mother rents rooms in their big Victorian house to Greta Gerwig's character, who is a young woman who has come back to her hometown after being in New York as an artist and having a brush with cancer. And Billy Crudup, the god Billy Crudup, Doc Manhattan himself, as a handyman stoner type with a just tremendous mustache.
Yeah.
And then Elle Fanning is the girl
Billy
next Crudup's
door. Getting paid to be Billy Crudup right now. It's like an amazing job he's doing.
The thing about Billy Crudup, just quick sidebar here.
Yeah.
Not to make this about me here, but I saw that dude in Arcadia on Broadway in like 1995.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, that's the greatest stage. I was 18. I was like, that dude is, I literally thought he was a god. I was like, he is the most handsome, compelling, charismatic, greatest actor. He's going to be the next big star. And then the weird thing about that dude is when you put him on a movie screen, he's kind of a twerp. Like he comes off as
he just
kind
has
of,
to be in the right role. He has to be the enigmatic guy and almost famous. You know,
He's not a leading man.
Right.
He just it's one of those interesting things, and he also has gotten better as he's gotten older because he's grown into the kind of weirdo self that he projects as. But sorry for the sidebar. The thing about this movie, which I also enjoyed quite a bit. There's a lot to recommend in it, and I'm just thrilled that movies like this get made, give opportunities for people like Annette Bening to give performances like this. I just wish it would have calmed down and gotten out of its own way. Because the movie is about what we're talking about, and it sort of shambles into the story in a wonderful way that I wish more movies did. It's very 70s in that you don't even know who these people are or what their relationship is to one another for a while. But the movie is strung together with this voiceover, this cloying voiceover that isn't enough to, you know, put it in the larger context and tell you the future. It also Ken Burns's their life. Mm-hmm. So he's like, the main character is getting into some darker music, and then it like literally cuts to like Getty images of punk rock. And I was like, yo, I know.
But some people
don't.
I know
what punk rock
is. But what if you didn't?
Then it wouldn't matter. You would hear the song playing on the stereo in that scene. You'd see the way Greta Gerwig is dancing to it, and you're like, that's an interesting thing that I'm learning.
Right. I think it was an interesting effort to stitch people's lives to history.
I just felt like there was a great movie here.
Yeah.
In between the stitching.
Yeah.
And that let me down. That's all. Quick sidebar, Greta Gerwig is just terrific
She's
in this movie.
Yeah.
She's always good and always compelling. But I just thought this was a really, in particular, really strong performance.
Yeah, I really liked the idea that this is, like, you go through this time, especially in the younger part of your life, where you are attaching yourself to sociocultural or historical moments to give yourself an identity. So whether it's, like, you're, like, I'm a Talking Heads fan, or I'm a Black Flag fan, or I am a feminist, or I'm a carpenter, or whatever you're doing, I'm a pottery maker, you're always looking for like some kind of identification through forces bigger than you.
Yeah.
And I thought that this movie captured that pretty well. There was something missing for it for me in there. And there were parts of it that I felt like kind of just meandered, but I couldn't help but be very moved by it.
Quick question. Where do you stand on the Fannings in general? We have never had Fanning talk.
Dakota's been kind of out of it for a minute,
she's
I think.
Been quiet.
Yeah, she's been kind of laying low, letting Elle take all her neon demon moments.
Her sister Wally pipped her. Nobody saw that coming. Let me say, I have never been a big Elle head. And other people have. Richard Brody, for example, The New Yorker, the whole La La Land review is just talking about how it's not a masterpiece like Sofia Coppola's Somewhere.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're losing me, Rich. You're losing me on that. Elle Fanning is legit really great in this
She's
movie.
She's good. Yeah.
Really compelling, really good part. It feels, for both these movies, maybe wrap up with this, like, it feels a little uncharitable to be nitpicking and critical because I want movies like this to exist. I mean, it's so hard, as you said, not just to make a musical, but to make anything personal. I mean, Damien Chazelle is very young. He couldn't make this movie unless he got Oscar nominated for Whiplash, unless he got Ryan Gosling to sign on. Mike Mills got to make this movie. I mean, it's about a teenage boy learning through feminism. Yo, we need this movie taught in schools in 2017.
Right.
But this puts us in this weird place of like, celebrate. You want to celebrate the art, but you also want to, you know, express an opinion on it. I just, maybe someone needs to do the master cut of this movie where they just cut out the parts I didn't like. What if like there's the Greedo shot first version of this where it's just like,
I'm sure.
It's Black Flag.
We'll
tell you about it later. You can Shazam it.
Google it.
You don't need to know.
All right, man. We'll be back Thursday to talk about the new season of Homeland and the upcoming season of Taboo. Maybe we'll even hit some Sherlock. Who knows?
Oh, do you think we will?
I watched it last night. It was very enjoyable.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, the thing about Chris, here's what's going to... You are the engine that keeps this podcast going, because you know what you do?
Watch television.
You just consume culture. You just eat it. You feast on it.
I got nothing else to do.
Great job, Baranski!
Just want to say thanks again to our sponsor, USA's Colony. From the executive producer of Lost, Carlton Cuse, comes another season of the USA original drama, Colony. In the not-so-distant future, Los Angeles has been invaded by outside forces, and Will and Katie Bowman must fight to keep their family safe, but nothing can prepare them for what is to come. Don't miss the new season of Colony, premiering Thursday, January 12th at 10/9 Central, only on USA.